Welcome to the Prosthetics and Orthotics Podcast with Joris Peels and Brent Wright, where we explore the latest developments and advancements in using 3D printing technology to create custom prostheses and orthoses, from in-depth interviews with leading industry experts, to case studies, to patient experiences. We delve into the exciting and innovative world of 3D printing and its role in the field of prosthetics and orthotics. Join us as we journey into the future of personalized healthcare with 3D printing.
Hello, everyone. My name is Joris Peels, and this is the Prosthetics and Orthotics Podcast with Brent Wright. How you doing, Brent?
Hey, Joris. I'm doing well. My son plays baseball. And he has recently started pitching as a starter, and he threw a no-hitter last night.
Wow.
And I was super proud of him. It's just neat to see your kids succeed, especially when you know they've put in the work, right? And so for him to throw a no-hitter and get the kind of accolades from his, and obviously it's a team thing because there's, you know, shortstop made some good plays and the outfield made some good plays, but I mean, the kid threw 92 pitches, 10 strikeouts. It's amazing. So it's really neat to see.
Oh, wow. That's a great amazing. So that's good. And so you said before, this is really important for you to be there for this kind of stuff, right?
Yeah. So pretty much like if anybody says, hey, Brent, can you, you know, come speak or can I call? So the first thing I do is I look at the calendar, and if either any of my kids are playing sports, the answer is no, because I only have so many times that I'm able to see them play. And that's actually one of the reasons why I didn't go to AMUG this year, is I would have missed three games. I love AMUG, but it's just not worth it. I only get to see him play, you know, 18 to 20 times a year, and I'm not going to miss three of those.
Okay. Speaking of prodigious children, Brent, we should talk about the Icarus.
Ah, what a segue. Yes. So we are sponsored by Filament Innovations for the rest of this season. And I talked to Mike this morning, and believe it or not, they have one Icarus for sale. And it's highly unusual that you could get one shipped out to you and probably have it next week. They typically run in batches of 5 or 10. And so there's usually maybe a month to 2 months lead time, depending on, you know, the sourcing of parts and that sort of thing. But right now is your opportunity where you could get one next week, and that's pretty neat.
All right, that's super cool, man, because Icarus is just for the uninitiated. It's a high-flow system. It's like around 30K, right? 31,000 or something like that?
Something like that, shipped to your door, yep.
And it's got a Typhoon nozzle from Dyes Design, right? And what else? It's a high flow, 1 kilometer of filament an hour system. And built like a tank, like we're used to, right?
Yeah. I mean, so it's really neat. So it'll print vase mode sockets and, you know, roughly an hour and a half. Transfems just a little bit longer than that. The vase mode sockets are where it's at for high speed, high strength. And then they also are kind of dipping their toes in with CPX. It's a copolymer-like material that is essentially the same, a polypropylene with some sort of additive in it for some extra give. And a lot of people are looking to use that for some temporary or preparatory prostheses. So it's a very interesting opportunity to have it all, you know, test sockets, some prep sockets, or extended wear sockets. So really neat.
Cool. Very, very good. All right. So who do we have today?
All right. I'm really excited to have John McQuiggan on the podcast. He works with Coyote Prosthetics and Orthotics, and I know we've had Matt on, and he does a lot of stuff in the background, but is, you know, a part of the foreground too, as far as not only some of the 3D printing side of things, but he's also a certified prosthetic orthotic assistant. He's a technician. So kind of does it all. He's had a couple positions where he's seen a lot of things, and he also has kind of fingers on the pulse of a lot of different technologies and such. So I'm really excited to have him share a little bit of his journey And also just his insight from another part of the country, and then working from kind of the vendor side as well, vendor and patient care side, because they have some of it combined at Coyote Prosthetics and Orthotics.
Okay, right. Super cool. Welcome, John.
Hi. One correction. Certified fitter, actually. Working on certified assistant, give it another half a year. It takes time. Finding a place that's actually willing to let you do that while doing 900 other things has been kind of nice. So not going to complain too much at the time it's taken me to get it. But anyways, I'm John McQuiggan. I'm a 3D guy is the way that most people say it in this building is, oh yeah, that's John, the 3D guy. Basically, I'm kind of a jack of all trades. The way you look at it is, you come to Coyote. If you come to our patient care, you might see me in patient care. You might see me in the lab. I do most of the modifications in the building for AFOs, sockets, little everything. It's kind of neat.
Okay. And how did you get involved in OMP in the first place?
Oh, that's a weird story. And I know everyone always comes on and says, well, I've got into the field a little weirder than most people. But I actually went to school originally for computer engineering, left traditional school and said, oh, this is kind of expensive and I'm going to go to junior college and get an associate's and transfer it in. Went, got an associate's in science and an associate's in art because I didn't know what I really wanted to do anyway. And as I was walking to the graduation office to get my diploma, I wandered by this big display at Joliet Junior that Mike Brenzik had set up. And it was just a bunch of prosthetic limbs and stuff. And I was like, huh, that is a field that exists, isn't it? That looks neat. Well, I went and talked to Mike. And 2 years later, I was a certified technician. And then I worked in Rockford and eventually moved to St. Paul and worked with somebody you guys might be familiar with, Tony Frucci. I think he's running Century's program at the moment. Great guy. Loved working with him. Extremely smart. And the reason I mention that is basically because I have had a lot of luck in the field in how I've gotten my experience. When I worked in St. Paul, I worked with Tony Frucci, Loretta Pedersen, and Dick Neeson. So I was trained by like 110 years of experience for a couple years. It was a whirlwind of useful, awesome information, and I loved every minute of it. But eventually, when I was there, I was at a Northern Plains chapter meeting, and a company called Prosthetics was set up there, and they were showing off all their 3D stuff, and I was like, ooh, this is neat. I have been interested in this for a while, and I talked to them for a bit, and they invited me to go out to their lab. I went out to their lab and looked at it and looked at all the cool printer stuff, and they were like, hey, you want to come run the lab? And I was like, what? And then I went to Prosthetics and worked there for a couple of years. So that was my first foray into 3D printing, was getting thrown headfirst into, cool, you know how to make a socket, we know how to do 3D, let's combine. And I was like, ooh, very interesting. So at that point, it was just me banging my head against figuring out how to make all this stuff work, because our motto was, if someone called us and asked us to do something weird, like, yeah, sure, why not? We can figure out how to make a pectus carinatum brace better than the off-the-shelf ones are, because you need a custom one for somebody that's got some weird cavus deformity that's in an odd spot. And a lot of that was great. Like, the R&D side of it has always been my real passion. It's everybody's passion in this field, honestly. But getting to help patients that other people have been unable to help, or not unable to help, but had a hard time helping, just because of the nature of their condition. And it's just great to be able to do that kind of stuff. spent a couple years at Protostatics. Eventually, COVID happened and a bunch of other stuff. I left the field for a little bit, went and worked in dental for a little bit. Learned a ton about DLP printing and SLI printing Invisaligns, but Invisaligns are special. It's the normal mouth guard things.
Like a night guard type of thing?
Yeah, like night guards or just the multiple trays of... I wore them for a year.
Like braces?
Yeah, like the invisible braces.
Okay, yeah.
I wore them for a year. I should remember what their official name is, but, you know. But, yeah, basically, I learned a lot there, and eventually I was sitting there, and I got a call from Matt, and he was like, hey, are you the guy I talked to at Protostatics when I came and visited Protostatics forever ago? And I was like, yeah, that's me. And he's like, cool, you want to come set up 3D here at Coyote? And I was like, yes, that's kind of what I want to do. And then that was 2 years ago-ish, and I've been here for 2 years doing cool 3D stuff. So that's my story of how I got here.
So I like that you just kind of fell into this, and that you kind of just like also kind of fell into the 3D printing thing. How do you learn about this? Because there isn't really a, you know, there isn't like a one, like there's like 3D printing for orthotist course or anything, right? So how would you advise people like, hey, like, you know, how do I learn about 3D printing? What's the best way?
Oh, the best way to learn about 3D printing, it depends on how you learn as a person. Most orthotist prosthetists are very hands-on. So the thing that I always tell people in this field, if they're looking to get into it, is go buy yourself a $200-$300 printer for at home and mess around with it. Learn some stuff about it, because you'll go to print something will go wrong, and you'll have to figure it out. That's exactly the same thing you do when you put a socket on somebody and something doesn't work. You have to figure it out. So people in this field are very good at always being able to look at a problem, figure out what the problem is, what could be causing it, and be able to figure it out. And if you want to do weird stuff with it, you know, that's a different story. You got to be able to figure out how to make it do odd things. And that's the thing with all the printers. Like, if you have like an Ender 3 or something, which are nice, fairly cheap, easily accommodatable printers, they're nice because you can get one for a reasonably cheap price at the start, and you can just modify everything about it until it's fantastic. And you don't have to. That's the thing, is you can just take the nozzle and take out the 0.4 it comes with. I think they come with 0.4s now, and put a 0.8 in, and you can move up and print bigger and bigger stuff with it. You're obviously limited by your bed size and all that other stuff, but, you know, it's one of those, you can figure out how to move up. And, like, for example, in that example, you move up to a 0.8 nozzle, suddenly you're like, oh, well, now my volumetric flow rate has changed completely, because you're pushing the same thickness of filament through a nozzle that's twice as thick. So you either have to go slower or hotter, or a combination of the two, to get the same flow, depending. And you'll learn tons about a print. You can print the same thing. Like, you can print a 1x1x1 cube 50 times with different settings and figure out exactly what your printer will do. It's one of the first things I do whenever I get a new printer. I use like 2x2x5, I think, just to get a weird angle on it. But so that's like a great place to start for normal people. If you're already like computer inclined, and you're already a practitioner that's scanning people's legs and sending the scan off to get carved, then you're already like halfway there, because being able to properly scan a leg is very important. It's one of those things of the quality of the cast you get dictates the quality of the socket you're going to get, or the AFO you're going to get. If you take, we have a CFAB here, and the thing I'll tell people is, if you send me a an AFO cast with 2-inch deep grooves of roping in it, I'll do my best, but I don't know how it's going to fit until you put it on. So, and it's the same thing with scanning. It's the quality of your initial scan dictates the quality of what whoever is modifying it has to work with. And if you're going to modify it yourself with a piece of software, that's where things can get even more complicated, because you can start moderately simple, which I know, not actually moderately, but you can go talk to Willowood, you can talk to Protear has a software, Vorum, any of the big boys, and they'll get you a demo for their modification software, and you can sit there and mess with it. And they're usually pretty cool with that. They'd rather sell you the software and are perfectly willing to give you a quick rundown of how stuff works. So that's always a good option on getting into the modification space digitally. Learning like MeshMixer or Freeform is a little bit more of a complicated matter. If you want to get crazy, like learning Blender or Ntopology is even harder, but most people don't need any of that. To do a like a 3D socket from absolute scratch, all you have to do is start out with a scan of somebody's leg. And if you can take a good scan of somebody's leg, you could throw it into one of the O&P modification softwares, and they're designed to try and be as orthotically, prosthetically simple as possible for people that don't super know how to use the modification softwares. Like, and that just makes it so much easier for somebody looking to get into the field. It's an excellent place to start because you're not throwing too much of an investment into something. Now, admittedly, MeshMixer is free. And there's a ton of online tutorials. So that's a different way to look at it. If you want to go free and learn all this on your own and not have to go to somebody else inside the field to figure out how to do stuff, open up MeshMixer, open up YouTube, and Google yourself MeshMixer prosthetic leg tutorial. And there's a couple of them on there that are pretty okay. I have one on there somewhere. I don't know. It might have gotten taken down, actually. But, well, I'd have to go look. But it's an easy starting point that you can just jump in at. MeshMixer is, I would say, moderately complicated. I wouldn't say it's super hard to learn. I wouldn't say it's super easy. So if you start on it and you're confused, don't get frustrated. Just Google what the tool you're trying to do is. Like, it's if you're trying to figure out how to add a posterior brim to your socket, you can just Google that and you'll get a fairly okay answer. It's not perfect and you'll have to figure stuff out, but that's the whole fun part of this, is having to learn how to do all this stuff. Because you'll run into different problems here and there and just have to figure it out. And that's one of the things I love about all this. Is there's no set perfect way to do it yet. And it's one of the things I'm working on here, is figuring out an easy methodology so that we can teach it to other technicians and stuff. And it's the same reason Coyote's Stable Flex socket exists, is it's a moderately simple, fairly formulaic version of a socket modification that you can follow, and they fit really good. And you can follow that formula, and then you can look at the thing you've created and go, okay, this is 90-95% correct. And if I make these 2-3 little modifications, I'll have a socket that fits 1-3 ply perfectly. And you can hit that almost every time if you follow a good formulaic approach to it, until you get somebody with, you know, interesting anatomy. Then you got to go outside the box, but that's what we love in the field, is a challenge, right, guys?
I can imagine. But okay, wait, and then a little bit, because we don't hear a lot about this. I mean, you got quite for people in the field, you've got quite a lot of experience with like DLP and SLA and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's newer. First off, like in OMP, do you see it as a widely something you could get wide use out of, or what would you tend to use that kind of stuff for?
With the advents of some of the newer resins with DLP, some of them are they're not like amazingly strong, but a lot of them are a lot stronger than you think they'd be. One of the downsides to most of the DLP printing has always been that they're brittle. Like you make the molds of, for example, if you make a bunch of molds of somebody's teeth, you have to be careful with them because they chip really easy. The resins, like even the dental mold quality resin you can buy, is one of those things where it's like, this stuff's kind of brittle even once it's cured and stuff. And yeah, resin printing is kind of a slight mess. And just like physically actually a mess because you've got all these chemicals that you're working with. You have to wear gloves. So it's kind of one of those, you want your resin printer off in the corner so that you don't spill stuff on stuff and people don't mess with the printer while it's going. I mean, that's an obvious thing anyway, but for some of the new DLP resins that have come out, there's some fairly high quality, tougher resins that have been coming out in recent years that are a lot more flexible, a lot more, they have some good elasticity to them. And just a lot of the cool things you can do with that. You can't build like a whole socket out of it yet. But if you need to make like, if you wanted to make something that you could slot into your 3D printer slot into a 3D print you're printing on your normal FDM printer, like a lock body or something to test something, you can do that. Now, they're not very strong, so I wouldn't send somebody out on them forever, but like having something to test an idea you have is great. If you want to put together, like if you need specifically a bumper for somebody's shoe or something, like if you're looking, I did this one the other day. We wanted to make a specific gel heel cup to put inside somebody's AFO. So I printed a mold and we filled it with resin, or not resin, sorry. We filled it with silicone, and now we have a perfect gel heel cup that matches the inside of his AFO perfectly. It was perfect. So it works great. It's one of those things where, yeah, you can do these things. Are they 100% perfect and ready for the O&P field? No, not really. That's more you're getting into the, I'm going to experiment with something and see how it works territory.
Yeah, I think that's good. I think that's an interesting point that I'd like to make real quick is that, yeah, with SLA DLP, you want to be really careful. You know, if you're going to use that for a long time, you're going to get resin on yourself. And the liquid resin can come up with a skin contact allergy for you. It could end up be very harmful in some cases as well, much more than that. And especially if you're going to be like you put it in your shop, use it for 10 years every day. Yeah, you need to be super careful with that kind of stuff. I mean,
oh yeah.
And I think it's important that we mention that, especially with the resin in liquid form and before you cure it and touching it with your hands, fingers. What happens to me a lot, for example, if I'm doing this, is I get a little drop on my face or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I just know that that's something I need to be really careful with if I'm going to be doing this for another decade or something. So wanted to tell people at home that if they... Yeah, they should be really, really careful in an industrial setting with this or a company setting. And also in curing the resin components before they get in touch with patients or people or just people you're working with, you have to be really careful with that as well. They don't get it on their hands and you fully cure the part as well.
So, John, you know, one of the interesting things that you say about it is about 3D printing in general is you do have to have a little bit of knowledge on just how to use what technology and potentially what situation, right? So, I mean, you talk about modification and just some of the basics of fitting a device and that sort of thing and how devices are made. Like, you can't just walk off the street and say you're going to make a prosthesis, or can you?
I wouldn't suggest it. There's a reason we all go to school and learn some stuff. And my general answer to that is there is, I'm paraphrasing this story, but somebody got their, I forget if it was the first guy that did it, but somebody actually got their master's thesis by printing their own alignment trays for their teeth. They 3D printed their own trays. I forget what college it was at, but I remember reading that story a while ago. So the answer is, you know, you can do stuff and not know exactly what you're doing and figure it out. My answer is always, would you put that on your mother? If you're going to build something and you're going to look at it and be like, yeah, I'm confident this will work, you might be willing to put it on a patient then. But always get consent from the patient. Be like, hey, I want to try this weird thing. We're not sure it's going to work. And most of your patients are, most of the patients I work with, at least, are usually like, yeah, that looks really cool. Let's try it. If it doesn't work, whatever, we'll go do the traditional thing. And that's great because we always have the backup. But coming in, like, for years in this field, where did we get technicians? We would hire people off the street and we would teach them how to do something. And it's the same thing for this. You can teach someone how to do this stuff, but having a good background base knowledge on how to do it before you get into deeper dives on the stuff is important. Is it 1,000% necessary? Depends. Like, if you have somebody that's super, super smart and can already knows a ton about 3D printing, you can teach them the O&P side of things. If you have somebody that has been a clinician for 20 years, you can teach them the 3D printing side of things as long as they're willing to learn. It's the same in both directions. You don't have to have a massive background in both to get into this. As long as you have a willingness to learn, you will do fine. I spend approximately an hour every night just looking up new things, figuring new things out, reading research papers or articles or whatever on 3D printing in general. I try and do an hour every day at the very least. Sometimes I fall into a rabbit hole and it's 2 a.m. and I'm like, oops. But generally, as long as you're willing to learn, you can figure this stuff out.
And one thing I think is really important, I think I want to point out, you mentioned this earlier, there's this thing, what I call settings drift, right? So you know, in the beginning, so many people, they try all sorts of materials, they try all sorts of shapes, and they're just doing all sorts of stuff. And also what happens is you end up kind of like changing some initial setting without knowing what you're doing and not what the effect is. And you mentioned two things. One is that feedback loop of like, if you do this, then this will change as well. And the other thing is, in the beginning of your life, you have damaged stuff. And the third thing is, I think that's a great point you made, just like print a bunch of cubes. That's what I tell people to do, like using the same filament, the same printer with more or less the same settings, print the same thing. It could be a keychain, whatever, over and over again, and then start changing things in a kind of like change one thing or change at least few settings in a really organized way to really understand what you're doing. And I think a lot of people too quickly want to print all sorts of different things. Mm-hmm. And then maybe there's an error in the STL and you're trying to figure it out by taking the machine apart. There could be all sorts of things that could go wrong.
Oh, yeah.
And so I think that print 50 cubes sounds like the most boring advice in the world, but it's a super good idea for getting to know a desktop machine.
Oh, yeah. And the other first thing I'll give people advice of, take those default settings that you get and save a backup of those. Like, even if it's just taking a screenshot of those with your phone, having a 0.0 to go back to is always good.
That is awesome. That is so true. And that includes firmware too.
Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely.
That's the worst, trying to find your firmware that you messed with step settings and all that stuff. And wondered where you started.
I can look at this .txt file on my desktop. That is, the printer firmware V6, really, really final version, definitely.
But that's so common. Like now, really, for real, two.
Yep.
V3B.
Yep. I have a socket modification I did the other day that has revision 3 underscore final underscore no really.
So I think you know, you have to be open to failure though, and be open to create an environment for yourself to fail and fail very quickly, and be super okay with that. And if you're okay with that, it's okay. If you were trying to do like something really crucial from the get go, I think it'd be really scary, or it'd be really demotivating, or it would just be you just wouldn't learn a lot, I don't think.
Oh yeah, and the other thing I'll say is don't be afraid to ask. Like I exist, Brent exists. Other facilities that do this exist. There's anytime I have ever called Mike Gorski, I have gotten probably half an hour of insight out of him instantaneously. So like all of us that are trying to do this we're not trying to do it just for us. We're trying to push the field forward. And we're willing to help you most of the time.
There's a wonderful community as well. One thing we don't really talk about is like, and one thing I've noticed that people do screw up a lot with is like, for example, not laying out your place of work, if you will, well, mm-hmm. or for example, not storing materials correctly as well. I think that kind of stuff, get to nail that down from the beginning, will really save you a lot of problems if you try to go to production later on.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Like the first thing I tell people is, hey, PETG is just like Vivac. You pull Vivac test sockets. You know they get air bubbles in them if you cook it too much or too hot. It's because PETG absorbs moisture from the air. You have to dry roast your filament basically in either a food dehydrator or a specific printer dehydrator. And you want to keep all your filament stored in a nice, cool, dry place. I have a bunch of sealed, not Tupperware, Rubbermaid tins that have the seal on the top of them, and they're just filled with silica beads because, of course, I want my filament to be dry. I can't tell you how many times I have a print where I have to pull out a new roll of filament and the seal on the filament was not great. And the first like 20 layers of my print, you could see the moisture in the filament. And then I'd pull that one off the bed and throw it away because my filament dehydrator that I keep my filament in has at least managed to dry the filament out enough that it's not popping and bubbling after layer 10.
Yeah, I think that's great. Moisture is your enemy. I think a little bit with PLA, even with PLA, mm-hmm. it makes it lots of brittle, pets you a little bit. But like if you get it into nylon and stuff like that, it's a nightmare, right?
Yeah.
Leaving it on the machine for like a day or whatever, then actually mm-hmm. more than half an hour, 40 minutes already has effect. So,
yep.
So you know, you'd be surprised how many people have the Tupperware box. Like also, like people are really tempted to have a drawer or a box and just put all these rolls in there. First off, you probably shouldn't be buying that many rolls in the beginning anyway, to have a few of them. And just from one vendor, just to make it, because, oh yeah, this is another wonderful one. If it's a different temperature, right? If it's a different color, then there probably is a different temperature or different settings. Mm-hmm. And there's different additives and different materials, even if they're from the same vendor, so they have different settings. So even like PLA white or PLA blue or whatever from the same company will be different. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you don't want to have a lot of different rolls and a lot of different open rolls in the beginning. So yeah, this mm-hmm. whole thing about this Tupperware, the stuff that it's not like Tupperware, it's like the good Tupperware you can like suck the air out of, mm-hmm. and getting these silica gel packets that you can get on I think it was on Alibaba, Amazon. You can buy like a whole bunch in one go. I think everybody does that once, and then you get enough of them for a couple of years. That kind of stuff, and also just labeling stuff, when you got it, what it's from, where it is, that kind of stuff. Which grade is that kind of thing? I think it helps so much, like because you're trying to control all these variables, and otherwise, like I have this behavior too. If I just like print for fun, then I'm just like, oh, I'll try this filament. Oh, glitter filament, cool. You know, and then before you know it, you're just like, you have no idea where you are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's back to my thing about backing everything up. Yeah, you get a new filament, cool. Make an offshoot of your current profile, label it that filament name. Start messing with the settings until you get it perfect. Just throwing your old settings at a new filament and seeing what it does, perfect idea. Like if you're going from PLA printing with a 0.4 nozzle to silk PLA printing with a 0.4 nozzle, yeah, throw your same settings at it. See what it does. Make adjustments from there. Do not be afraid. You're going to waste 20 grams of your kilogram of filament figuring out how to get it to print right instead of hitting print on a 200-gram object and discovering that your print settings stink.
What slicer are you using nowadays, John?
Oh, that's always the fun question. I'm using the old version of Simplify for sockets for the most part, because that's the easiest slicer that I've had. It's the easiest slicer that I've used that does multiple profiles very well, in case you're looking to do like the bottom, the lock body of our socket, because we at the Coyote have the drop-in lock. So I want to have that nice body, but my body's thickness is different. My lock body's thickness is different than my actual socket wall thickness, because I want that bottom piece to be sturdier. So I have reinforcements and other stuff on the bottom of the socket. So I don't use the same profile for the middle of my socket as I do the bottom, as I do the top. So Simplify is great for that, because you can just throw three profiles into it and tell it, hey, for up to 75 millimeters, print with this settings. And then from 75 to 200, print with these. And then from 200 to 300, print with these. And that works great. But I also use Cura for a bunch of stuff. I use Prussia for some stuff. I use KISS occasionally. Haven't gotten enough time with KISS to have a good feeling for it either way. I definitely don't have my settings perfect in it for any of the printers I have in the building. So still working on that. But like Cura is simple. You want to be simple with Cura. You have the simple version of it on the left, and it just gives you like 10 settings you can change. Excellent. Great place to start out for somebody that doesn't know a ton about 3D printing.
Okay, I think that's good advice as well. And I think one thing, actually, this is kind of bad advice because I don't actually do it myself, but I did it for a couple of months. It was beautiful. Is to keep like kind of like one notebook and then to write down stuff that you're actually like the settings, writing down what settings you used and write down also when you did what and what you changed and all this. And just for a person like me, I can be very chaotic, for example. That really kind of helps me lock everything down a little bit more as well. But do you use any other, okay, MeshMixer, obviously you use any other software stuff that you haven't mentioned, or?
I am nowhere near as good as Brent with Freeform, but I do know how to use it. I use it for socket stuff sometimes. I use it for AFO stuff sometimes. It's a very robust software. I will give them credit for that. I find it to be slightly complicated for some things that I do, where it's like I could do this in 10 minutes in MeshMixer, or I could figure out how to do it in Freeform and it'd probably take me half an hour. And that's just because I don't know Freeform as well. And that's an advice I'll give you, is if you learn, it's the difference between like Fusion and SolidWorks. SolidWorks is great, but it's really expensive. Fusion 360 is, it's not like free. If you have a college email, it can be mostly free. Most colleges will get you a student key, especially if you take a class related to CAD. But that's one of those other softwares that it was great to learn. Like, you can do a ton of cool stuff with sockets in Fusion 360 or SolidWorks. Fusion, I have found, is actually slightly easier to work with meshes than SolidWorks at the moment. That might be because I don't know enough about SolidWorks. We have an engineer here who is masterful with SolidWorks, and I ask him for advice on it all the time. And we have a machinist here that's super great with Fusion, and I ask him questions all the time. And it's always a learning process. So to fully answer your question, my full software suite is MeshMixer, Freeform, Blender, Fusion 360, and SolidWorks are the ones I have on this computer in front of me.
Okay. And okay. So now I'm like a noob. I'm sitting here, I'm learning, listening to all this stuff. I'm thinking, oh, this is good stuff. I'm here noting stuff down. Would you start with any one particular thing first? Would you say, hey, you know what? Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yep. MeshMixer.
We're like, we're the biggest like MeshMixer fanboys on the planet, I think, in this podcast.
Yep, it's free. I cannot argue with free.
Is YouTube, right? And so are those tutorials. There's you can get super dangerous there.
Oh yeah. It's super great because you'll learn a ton of stuff. You'll fail a million times and you'll learn exactly why you failed. And when you fail, you learn. And that's the whole point. And if you want to get like super deep dive into Mesh Mixer, you can contact, there's a couple places that do like advanced courses for it.
Derek did it for a while, but he is in the Virgin Islands enjoying life there. So I don't think he's doing it that much anymore. And I think Joe is doing some of that. And then Arthur's doing a lot of this stuff in the ZBrush, which is very interesting as well.
Oh, I've been meaning to try ZBrush. That reminds me. Put that on my list.
Do you like watching your computer do nothing?
Considering I work with Blender, whenever I hit render, I go walk away for 10 minutes. So
it's good for coffee breaks. ZBrush is a very great, interesting sculpting software. It's a very different way of thinking. It's either works really well for you or not at all kind of a thing. And also, while we're doing it, we're going really deep into this. I like this. Are there any tools that you really like? I have, for example, just some other stuff that you use throughout the day.
Go on Amazon and buy yourself the tiny little red tiny clippers that are recommended for whenever you start searching for 3D printers. The little wire cutter looking things. They are amazing. What are they called? They're like the CHP little snippers. They're great for just general purpose. I need a tiny little pointy tip to grab a piece of filament. Little flush cutters.
Yeah, that's what it is. Flush cutter. Right?
Yeah.
They come with a bunch of printers as well, huh?
Yep. That's exactly where I found them. And then I discovered that when I bought a different printer, they didn't come with one. And I was like, oh, I need another one of these. Where do you get these? Oh, they're not that expensive. Okay. Other than that, just general tools I use all the time. Duct tape. Duct tape is your best friend.
What about like a mouse or 3D connection stuff? Anything like that that you find kind of indispensable?
Oh, no, I just have a normal. I have an MX Master from Logitech just because I really like that mouse. But my answer to that is find a mouse you're comfortable with. If you want to get like what do you use, Brent? You have a mixer board?
Oh, I mean, that's for so I've got a mixer and soundboard, but for video and audio. But one thing that I've been meaning to do, so I used to use a 3D connection, 3D space mouse or whatever.
Oh,
but
yeah.
it would fight my haptic device. I kind of got away from the 3D connection and only use the haptic. But one of the things that I've been wanting to do, and I haven't done it, maybe because I'm a little bit lazy, but is use the Stream Deck to create shortcuts.
Yeah, that's what I was meaning. I've seen a lot of people. I have a bunch of friends that are animators, and they use Stream Decks for shortcuts. They have a ton of shortcuts on their tablets and stuff, but I have a friend that uses Blender and they just have an entire Stream Deck set up that's just all Blender functions. So it's like, that's a great idea because just being able to click a button is a lot faster than scrolling through three menus to find something.
That's right. Yeah. So that's why I'm, and I think that's my suggestion to a lot of people is, with Mesh Mixer, that's how I started Mesh Mixer and Fusion 360. Mm-hmm. But what was happening is that it was just taking too long for that workflow. And then, whether Mesh Mixer crashes sometimes.
Sometimes.
I've never had Mesh Mixer crash. Have you?
No. Kidding. Save often, everyone. Save often.
Yes. No. Save often. And then you have the, final Rev 2, final before render, whatever. But anyway, what I was getting at was one of the reasons why I moved to Freeform was efficiency. So I increased my efficiency probably 5x going to Freeform. And then, so that is the reason why you advance. It's not necessarily, because I want to use the haptic device. It's like, oh no, I'm running out of time and I've got to figure out how to use my time wiser.
Yes.
And that's when you make the jump into a paid for software. So a lot of people will say, Brent, you know, it's Freeform's expensive. Well, yes, it's expensive, but so is not being able to do five times the amount of work in an hour. And so that's really the decision making. And I think that's one of the things that I would suggest for people, our listeners, when you're looking at orthotic and prosthetic specific software, it's going to be a time savings. You know, you're going to know where the menus are. You're not going to have to learn as, you know, as much. Some of it may be quote unquote more intuitive. So it becomes a time saver, and that's when you make those jumps.
Yep. The other advice I will give is if you're a first time mesh mixer user, click help and then keyboard shortcut and just print that and stick it on the wall in front of you.
Ooh, that's good. I have not done that. And that's the best tip ever.
Yeah, that's exactly what I did when I learned how to use it, except the last page, because the hot box sometimes works and sometimes decides it doesn't want to work. So mesh mixer's free, everyone.
Yeah. Okay. And then another thing, I mean, okay, you're a technician, right? So what's it like working with these orthotists, these prosthetists? We get them on most of the time, but I can imagine it could be very frustrating.
Oh, the opposite. Depends on your orthotist prosthetist. Everyone's different. I never judge, but everyone is different. Everyone has different ideas. I've worked with prosthetists that 100% want the thing the exact way they want it, and will come sit in the lab with you and be like, no, we want to do it like this. And that is what it is. Like, that's the way they want the device because they saw the patient and they know exactly what needs to happen for that patient. And then you'll get other prosthetists that look at you and go, you've been doing this for 10 years. You know what to do. And they just leave it in your hands. And then you get other prosthetists that will walk up to you and be like, hey, so this is what this guy is doing. What do you think? And I love the challenge of having that brought to me of just, hey, we've got this weird situation. This patient has, we've got a BK patient that doesn't have a fibula at all. Like, it got taken out. Cool. Awesome. That changes the entire muscular structure of the patient's leg. So you can no longer grab in the same spots. Cool. Let's figure out how to lift the patient out of the socket so they're not stabbing their tibia into the bottom of their leg repeatedly when they walk. And it's cool stuff like that. Working with prosthetists that care has always been my greatest, the thing that keeps me in the field. And I just love it. I love getting to help people is my real answer to this. If it was any other thing, one of the reasons I went to dental for a little bit was I didn't feel like I was helping people as much as I could be. And I got offered the chance to come back and help people again. And I love it.
I think that's interesting too, that you say, you know, what's neat and what I see now, especially kind of with this new generation of prosthetists, orthotists, they do embrace some of the technology, but they also lean on those that have a specialty in one sense. So like for John, I mean, you're a technician and so you've been doing it for 10 years. Well, they've been a clinician for maybe say they're a newer clinician, say they maybe 5 years or something like that. And they know that you have this body of knowledge that they can draw from. And they're like, yes, do it the way that you think is best for my patient. And then they will run with it from there, right? When they go to fit the patient or what have you, that's in their wheelhouse. And I think it's a definitely mind shift for a lot of these clinicians, especially when you're dealing with not only the technician side of things, but the digital aspect of it, is trying to allow them to be creative, yet keep their hands doing the things that they're best at, which is evaluating the patients and fitting the patients. They're not necessarily the best at fabricating, even though historically that's what they used to do.
Oh yeah.
And so I think that's an interesting answer is, hey, let me do what I'm good at doing. Let's collaborate and you do what you're good at doing. You go fit the patient, give me feedback. Well, let's make it better the next time around.
Yeah. And I'm in that weird, unique position where I'm both I work both sides. I'm occasionally over in patient care doing the assistant thing. Occasionally I'm a technician. Like I was saying earlier, I do almost all the modifications here. So whenever we need to fill a cast manually and do one by hand, like I don't have a printer that can print a CAFO. Like I could send it out, but that's, I have two other technicians that work here. Russ has been here for 20 years. His body of knowledge is ridiculous. And Chad can bend up a CAFO in like, I think it's like 20 something minutes, which is, you know, that's impressive for me. I'm good at bending metal, but a CAFO still takes me like an hour. So it's one of those things of rely on the people that are good at what they do. We have specialists in the field for a reason. Never be afraid to ask your technician a question, because if the technician doesn't know the answer they will give you is, I don't know, you're the clinician, you should know this. And you know what? That's a perfectly valid answer. If you don't know the answer, fine. I'd rather you tell me you don't know the answer. That's perfect. Because then we can figure it out together.
Okay. That sounds really wonderful, man. Well, thank you so much for being here today, John.
No, no problem. I appreciate you guys for getting me on the show.
Okay, perfect. Thank you as well for being here today, Brent.
Yes, this was great. And John, thank you for sharing this. I know our listeners are going to get a lot of really great insight on where to get started. And so I really hope that they will take it to heart and get the ball moving. So I really appreciate, you know, everything you do and pushing this forward really for the betterment of patients, not only now, but in the future.
Mm-hmm. That has always been my goal and dream, is just to, you look at, we've been doing the same stuff for 50 years. We need to move forward. Everyone else is.
All right. And well, thanks everyone. Thank you for listening. And thank you to Filament Innovations for sponsoring this episode. Check out that Icarus 3D printer if you want a high flow system that's a workhorse and is available right now. Tom, Norris, and Brent sent you. Have a great day.